heavy winter storm hits southeast US, leaving 100,000 people without power and 3,000 flights cancelled. North Korea is said to have launched an unidentified projectile, possibly a ballistic missile, towards its east coast. Also coming up, several European capitals see new protests against COVID-related lockdown and vaccination measures. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, a winter storm combining high winds and snowfall sweeps through parts of the US southeast, disrupting normal life there. The storm leaves nearly 100,000 people without power due to falling trees and fences. Many roads and streets are now coated with a treacherous, frigid glaze. More than 2.5 centimeters of snow fell per hour in some parts of the states of North and South Carolina, as well as Georgia, Tennessee, and Virginia. Thousands of flights were also cancelled on Sunday. Conditions are expected to worsen further, especially in North Carolina. Parks and libraries were closed in the state on Sunday in some areas. Weather stations recorded wind gusts traveling at more than 80 kilometers per hour. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has once again unleashed a litany of claims of voter fraud in the 2020 presidential election.
Why aren't they investigating November 3rd, a rigged and stolen election, without getting to the bottom of which we will never have a fair and free democracy? Why aren't they looking at that?
Trump made the remarks during a rally in Florence County in the state of Arizona. He called the storming of the Capitol by his supporters on January 6, 2021, quote, a protest against a crooked election. He also took the opportunity to hit his successor, Joe Biden, saying his administration is incompetent. Trump supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol in the hope of preventing lawmakers from certifying Biden's victory, but to no avail. Angry protesters then clashed with police and tried to beat up a number of Democratic lawmakers. They also damaged parts of the building housing both wings of Congress. In some developing news, South Korea and Japan report another suspected ballistic missile launch by the North. The projectile, which they claim was fired towards the East Coast, would be the fourth this month if confirmed. The revelation about Pyongyang's new launch comes from Japan's Coast Guard and the South Korean military. The North had already carried out two tests of what it called hypersonic missiles. Following that, the U.S. imposed sanctions on five people linked to North Korea's ballistic weapons program. The sanctions were the first the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden. The North, however, called Washington's measure provocation, adding that the U.S. was intentionally escalating the situation. Pyongyang says its recent missile tests are an exercise of its right to self-defense in the face of potential regional threats. The United States once again accuses Russia of trying to invade Ukraine, warning Moscow of even tougher sanctions. Jake Sullivan.
What we have laid out is a very clear message to the Russians, and we've done so in concert and unison with our allies, that if they do further invade Ukraine, there will be severe economic consequences and a price to pay. And yes, of
course, Jake Sullivan there. He also says the U.S. and its allies will give an appropriate response if Moscow is confirmed to have been behind the recent cyber attacks on Ukraine. On the other side, Russian officials are demanding written responses to security proposals they've offered to the U.S. and NATO. Moscow wants guarantees that NATO's eastward expansion will be stopped and that troops and military hardware will be removed from areas close to its borders. Russia also rejects the West's claims about its intentions to attack Ukraine, saying its troop movement along the borders is to ensure its security in the face of NATO's advances. We earlier discussed the tensions between Russia and the West in depth during our news review program.
Time now for the news review. Prospects of reconciliation between the U.S. and Russia over Ukraine remain bleak following bilateral talks in Geneva. The U.S. is now threatening Russia with a swift response if it invades Ukraine. Senior U.S. diplomat Victoria Nuland says the U.S. plans to inflict very sharp pain on Russia should it attack Ukraine. She says that the U.S. has prepared 18 scenarios in the event of a Russian attack on Ukraine. She says, however, Washington is still open to dialogue with Moscow and intends to respond to its demand for security guarantees. On the other side, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says Moscow and Washington are on totally different tracks. He says this is disturbing for Russia. The remarks follow meetings between Russian officials and the U.S. and NATO earlier this week. The West accuses Russia of planning to attack Ukraine. Moscow rejects the allegation outright. Now, inviting a couple of guests now to get some more insight on this. Jerome Hughes, our correspondent in Brussels, is joining us. Also, Markis Papadopoulos, historian, public analyst, and author in London. Good to see you both, gentlemen. Now, let's go to Brussels first. Jerome, diplomacy has apparently failed. The two sides are, you know, keeping up the harsh rhetoric, as you know. So given the fact that they're very far from reaching an agreement, so how seriously should we take the threat of a new conflict erupting in Europe?
Well, Behrouz, it's difficult to say. Diplomacy has failed so far, but certainly we haven't reached the end game yet. And, you know, just in the past half an hour, I was speaking to one of my contacts in the European Commission, a senior official there. And the European Commission, its job is to formulate policy in terms of building up sort of a sanctions package, a potential new sanctions package that would be applied against Moscow. And they're coordinating closely with London and also Washington to try and build up this potential package of sanctions. And what I'm told is that, you know, in the event that Russia invades Ukraine, which of course Moscow denies that's the intention, well then these sanctions would be applied, and apparently they would be the strongest sort of sanctions package that have ever been put together. They would be sort of targeting sort of all aspects Russian society, Russian citizens living abroad. And the idea would be, you know, apart from a financial impact on Vladimir Putin, that it would have a political impact on him. But really what I'm also told is that what's most likely to happen at this stage is that the West is going to give assurances to the Kremlin to say, look, you know, there are no immediate plans for Ukraine to join NATO. We'll scale back our military operations close to your borders and on the Black Sea, and to just give concrete assurances to Vladimir Putin that, you know, this is going to de-escalate from the Western side. Because really the feeling is that there's no military option here. I mean, if you leave the nuclear weapons aside, even on a conventional war footing, Russia has an enormous military capabilities. It has a fantastic defense system right along its borders in terms of anti-missile system. It has a huge number of troops. It has state-of-the-art equipment. And so even the feeling is that, you know, NATO officials feel that there's not even really a conventional war option with Russia, apart from the fact that it has this huge arsenal. Again, of course, always in the background is the possibility of it escalating to nuclear, which would, of course, be catastrophic. So the only show in town here, Behrouz, according to the people I've been speaking to, is a situation of diplomacy and to try and scale things back. And, of course, they will be asking for Russia to try and give something in return. The elephant in the room, of course, is Crimea. I mean, I was speaking to one analyst recently, and he said, look, you know, perhaps if you're going to criticize Vladimir Putin and his government, you could say that maybe they rushed into Crimea a bit too quickly, because the 2014 referendum, there was the overwhelming majority of the people of Crimea wanted to rejoin the Russian Federation. So perhaps he should have played the long game with that. Mm-hmm. That's a game he would have won in the long term. Perhaps he did that too quickly, perhaps without coordinating better with Kiev and with Brussels and with Washington and so on. And that continues to be sort of a major bone of contention, and it's sort of the backdrop to all of this.
All right. Okay, now let me ask Marcus this. Marcus, one basic argument that Russia is making is that NATO promised to stop enlarging beyond this what is called Cold War area, but then those promises were broken, as you know. And NATO is arguing that it's decisions made by consensus, not by promises made by individual member states, alluding to the United States, do not count as the alliance's formal policy. So which side do you believe is giving a more plausible argument?
There are two words which accounts for the dangerous level of global tension today between America and Russia: NATO expansion. And there are two words which account for NATO expansion: American exceptionalism. It is indeed the case, the irrefutable case, that in 1990, the Soviet Union consented to German reunification on the grounds that NATO would not expand beyond Germany's eastern border, namely into Eastern Europe. That was an assurance, albeit a verbal one, which was given to the then Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev by George Bush Sr., Helmut Kohl, François Mitterrand, and also the then American Secretary of State, James Baker, who told Gorbachev that there will not be one inch eastwards of NATO expansion. But, alas, the Americans violated that oral assurance which was given to Mikhail Gorbachev, and that is why NATO expanded not just into Eastern Europe, but also into the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. So Russia has a legitimate grievance, but time is not on the side of the Russians. Because whilst American policymakers are saying that they are prepared to keep on discussing the crisis surrounding Ukraine with the Kremlin, at the same time, the Americans are arming to the teeth the Ukrainian armed forces. They are expanding NATO's presence in Eastern Europe and also in the Baltic states. The Americans are widening their naval presence in the Black Sea. And on top of that, Washington is encouraging Sweden and Finland to join NATO. So you see, the Americans are demonstrating their specialism in duplicity. In public, they are calling for further dialogue with Russia, but at the same time, they are going to extreme lengths to undermine and threaten Russian national security.
Right. Okay. I'm sorry to jump in. That's all the time we have. Thank you very much. Jerome Hughes, our correspondent in Brussels, and Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author in London. And that's it for this edition of the News Review.
In other news, several European countries have witnessed new protests against lockdown measures and vaccination mandates as the coronavirus crisis continues to wreak havoc throughout the continent. Thousands of people hit the streets of the Dutch capital Amsterdam, urging their government to lift month-long curbs. Malta saw its biggest protest against COVID rules yet. Hundreds marched through the capital Valletta against mandatory COVID passes to access public places. Over 1,000 people also held a similar rally in the Hungarian capital Budapest. The protest was organized by a far-right group that has been advocating anti-vaccine and anti-immigration policies. Staying in Europe, the chairman of the UK ruling Conservative Party joins the chorus of criticism over the parties that were held at Downing Street during COVID lockdowns.
This event was totally wrong. It shouldn't have happened. The Prime Minister has rightly apologised for it. People feel angry about what's been going on in Downing Street. I feel angry about what's going on in Downing Street. But the correct process now is to get to the full facts and then for the Prime Minister to appear before Parliament, which he will do, and to be held to account.
Oliver Dowden, however, says the public don't want a leadership contest and Boris Johnson must remain as Prime Minister. He says the Premier, at the same time, must respond effectively and address the culture within the government once the facts are established. The UK government has launched an internal inquiry into revelations about multiple gatherings by Johnson's staff during COVID lockdowns. Johnson himself has apologised for attending one of the gatherings that took place in the garden of his residence in May 2020. But the investigation and the apology have done little to quell the outrage. Johnson now faces resignation calls even from within his own party. The opposition, Labour, has seized the opportunity with both hands.
I think he broke the law. I think he's as good as admitted that he broke the law. And after all, Downing Street has now apologised to the Queen for some of the parties that have gone on. And I know that the government's holding position is let's all wait for the Sue Gray report. But I think it's pretty obvious what's happened. There's industrial scale partying that's been going on at Downing Street. Not much of it is really denied. And I think that the public have made up their mind. I think the facts speak for themselves. I think the Prime Minister broke the law. I think he then lied about what had happened.
Johnson has been under relentless fire since last month. That's when a video emerged showing his staff laughing and joking about a Downing Street party during a 2020 Christmas lockdown. Anger grew after more such parties were disclosed, and all those followed condemnation on several other fronts. They included Johnson's handling of a sleaze scandal, the awarding of a lucrative COVID contracts, and the refurbishment of his Downing Street flat. A recent poll has given Labour a 10-point lead over the Conservatives, the biggest such advantage since 2013. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. World food price inflation has more complex causes than other price increases, and addressing it effectively requires a different set of strategies. but rich country governments are not sufficiently discussing them, and the world's poor are continuing to suffer as a result. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jayati Ghosh Ryder. This article is published under the heading, World Food Price Inflation Hits Poorest the Hardest. Stay tuned for more. The question of how best to control inflation is back on the economic policy agenda, and opinion is divided about how to address it. The mainstream view emphasizes the need for tighter monetary policies and regards higher interest rates and reduced liquidity provision as justified, even if they dampen the fragile economic recovery now underway in many countries. Others argue that today's inflation is transitory, reflecting temporary supply bottlenecks and labor market shifts, and will soon correct itself. In rich countries, policymakers still rely mainly on macroeconomic tools to tackle inflation. But one set of price increases is different from the others: food price inflation. Not only does this phenomenon have a much greater direct impact on people's lives, especially in developing economies, it also reflects more complex causes, and addressing it effectively requires a completely different set of strategies. Unfortunately, governments are not discussing them sufficiently. This neglect is deeply troubling. At the end of 2021, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization's Food Price Index was at its highest level in a decade and close to its previous peak of June 2011, when many were warning of a global food crisis. Moreover, last year's increase was sudden. From 2015 to 2020, food prices had been relatively low and stable, but soared by an average of 28% in 2021. Much of this surge was driven by cereals, with maize and wheat prices increasing by 44% and 31% respectively. But prices of other food items also shot up. Prices for vegetable oil hit a record high during the year. Sugar was up by 38%. And price increases for meat and dairy products, though lower, were still in the double digits. Food price inflation currently exceeds the increase in the overall price index and is even more alarming given the significant decline in workers' wage incomes during the COVID-19 pandemic, especially in low and middle income countries. This lethal combination of more expensive food and lower incomes is fueling catastrophic increases in hunger and malnutrition. There are many possible reasons for this spike in food prices. Some are systematic. Supply chain problems, especially regarding transportation, have been a major factor driving price increases for a wide range of commodities. Thus, grain prices rose rapidly in 2021, despite record global output of nearly 2.8 billion tons. Energy prices are also important in determining the cost of producing and transporting food. The large increase in oil prices in 2021 obviously affected the food prices faced by consumers. In addition, more frequent extreme weather events make crop output more volatile and reduce yields. Some have argued that prices of agricultural commodities as disparate as Brazilian coffee Belgian potatoes and Canadian yellow peas, now widely used by the food industry to produce plant-based meat substitutes, rose sharply last year after weather events induced by climate change undermined output. In March 2021, the FAO warned that increasingly frequent climate-related disasters were affecting agricultural supplies. Droughts are the single greatest threat, accounting for more than one-third of crop and livestock losses in low and lower middle-income countries. But floods, storms, pests, diseases, and wildfires have also become more intense and widespread, as was evident last year. We can expect much more climate-related pressure on food production in the coming years, with developing regions in Asia and Africa likely to be hit hardest. The threats to food production from climate risk underscore the need for greater international cooperation to tackle global warming and its consequences. Sadly, such collaboration seems unlikely. But some of the other factors contributing to food price increases are the direct result of policy and regulatory changes. These include the significant increase in stockpiling by governments and consumers, driven by fears that new waves of the COVID-19 pandemic will put further pressure on food supplies. The expectation of future food price increases then becomes self-fulfilling, owing to higher current demand. Last November, the FAO estimated that the global food import bill in 2021 would be the highest ever, at more than $1.75 trillion, a 14% increase from 2020 and 12% higher than the FAO's forecast just a few months earlier. This is bad news for lower-income economies, which may have more pressing food import requirements than other countries, but could be squeezed out of global markets because of increased demand. The other important factor is financial speculation in food markets, which has recently experienced a revival. Food commodities became an asset class for financial deregulation in the United States in the early 2000s, and there is significant evidence that this played a major role in destabilizing food price volatility of 2007 to 2009. In recent years, these commodities had become less attractive to investors, but that changed during the pandemic. Despite high volatility, long positions in major food commodity markets were significant and positive for most of 2021, suggesting that financial investors were expecting prices to increase. The volume of such investments grew substantially last year, enabled by persistent regulatory loopholes and availability of cheap credit to financial institutions. Unlike some of the more systematic forces affecting food supply and prices, in the medium term, policymakers could easily address the issues of stockpiling and speculation. But that requires governments to accept that these are problems and to master the will to address them. Until they do, food price inflation will continue to hit the world's poor the hardest.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadali, and you are now listening to the program Viewpoints. Joining us in the studio is our dear friends, Brother Ali Alawiyan and Brother Habib. I thank you both for joining us because we value your company a lot.
Thanks to you, brother. It's a good pleasure for us to be here.
Today, dear brothers, we will talk about lying. Just to start it off easily, just to ease into our discussion, I want to ask dear Brother Ali Alawiyan, what is the Islamic viewpoint on lying?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Basically, lying in Islam is known to be as a sin. So, no one in Islamic, let's say, environment, Islamic jurisprudence among the fuqaha and religious authorities considered it as, let's say, an ordinary act. So lying by itself is a sin, and sometimes this lying becomes a greater sin. That is a kabira sin. That is
a greater sin.
When actually it enters the let's say the time that, for example, you attribute something to the Prophet and his household, which is not exactly is, or to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Right.
So it becomes this lying again, even is more greater, and also it is considered as a great sin. So
because a lie, it actually produces another lie to keep up this lie going, and then you lie and lie and lie and lie.
It's not like that. It's not always like that. But right. It does result in it. Like I was, my brother was saying that lying has levels to it. Sometimes you lie, I lie, for example. I tell you, my brother Alawi did this. That was lying, for example. Right. So that's one lie. Another higher level of lying that is considered a major sin is lying by attributing false statements to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and his Prophet.
So propaganda, false propaganda.
I'm not going to call it propaganda, false statements. These false statements, even if it was one letter, you know, in the Arabic language is very precise, even one letter or changing one haraka or symbol in the Arabic grammar, and therefore you change the meaning. When you change the meaning, you're changing what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants for humanity to reach justice.
So Brother Habib, you say, and actually Islam says, because we're in agreement here, lying is not permissible.
Yes, sir.
All forms of lying, Brother Habib, or do we have some permissible forms of lying?
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan ar-rajim, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, because when I entered the, you know, the chat with Brother Alwiyan, I didn't say it.
They need to put it here.
So this topic has been highly debated in Al-Makasib Al-Muharrama, written by Sheikh Al-Ansari, and the scholars and the fuqaha, the jurists that come after him, give their ideas and thoughts on the topic based on what Sheikh Al-Ansari stated, whether they agree, they disagree, they put the detection, the evidence, the proof. Before him, Al-Allama Al-Majlisi has, in Bihar Al-Anwar, mentioned the topic of, in Mar'at Al-Uqud, Volume 10, he mentioned, because Al-Kafi has a chapter called Bab al-Kadhib, Al-Allama al-Majlisi explained the sayings available about lying, and at the end, he talks about one of the muhaqqiqin, and it might be Imam al-Ghazali, from the Sunni scholars. He puts out his idea that lying is by itself, without any, let's say, secondary titles or secondary subjects, is considered a sin. But there might be secondary titles that change it from lying into not lying, or from lying into what? Into permissible lie.
Such as?
Not white lie, permissible lie.
Yeah, we do not say white lie. Yeah. Such as?
Such as, for example, fixing between your brothers.
Mm.
For example, you and Mr. Alawiyan got in a fight for some reason. For example, you guys were on the show.
God forbid.
You got in the fight for some reason.
Right.
So I go to Mr. Alawiyan. I tell him, you didn't tell me anything. All you did was smash and bash him. But I go to Mr. Alawiyan. I tell him, Habibi, Brother Musa was saying that you are one of the best guests he ever hosted a show with.
Yeah.
Right? And then he just looks at me all happy. I go to you. I tell you, Brother Musa, Brother Oliver Young said you are one of the best looking men in the world.
Right.
Yes, and you all looked at me very happy. And then you come, brothers, and forget all your problems. And you forget that you're even good looking and that you're a good guest, for example. So
Sheikh Ali, this is the classic example. Islah between the mu'mins.
Yes.
Yeah. This is one case.
This is one case. Any other cases?
Yeah,
or?
There are two more cases for the permissible lying. I mean, but it doesn't mean that lying is something good that you are permitted
to. You call it
to.
Permissible lying. The sheikh just calls it not lying.
Because no, we don't have a saying that
it became something else.
Kadib.
Yeah.
Tanzil al-kadib manzilat adam al-kadib. We have a saying where it says lying is not lying.
But you mean the same thing, just for the listeners. Yeah. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, the word that is good for a good translation for that to... presented to the listeners is something exactly what Sheikh said.
Right.
So another case is that you're in an urgency case. For example, a person who's keeping, let's say, a trust of another brother in faith, and another, let's say, a tyrant person comes to him to take it from him. He can say, okay, it's not with me anymore. So just to keep the, let's say, the benefits of another Muslim brother.
Protect your fellow believer or his properties.
Yeah. There is another case that you are allowed, again, is inside the family. But does it mean that we have to lie to our wives or, let's say, to kids?
What does that mean?
Let's say, specifically, I want to mention, in the cases of financial issues, when, for example, the wives are asking for, let's say, some expectation, and they have some expectation from the husband.
There's no money.
And there is no money.
Okay, yeah, just
emphasize on that.
Yeah.
There's no money.
And there is no money. You can't just promise them for some later time just to give them while you have not, you don't have it. You can promise them.
So that's a lie.
Yeah, that's a lie that works for not lying. I don't know. Well, how did you define it?
Is a diplomatic solution.
Tawriya? No. The same lie. What was the definition of this lie? You said, what did you call it?
That permissible lie.
Is it good to call it permissible lie?
Permissible lie.
Is it permissible lie? Yeah, not lying, permissible lying.
So we are not looking at it as a lying in the way that, for example, all the relations between the family members be based on this lie, or a series of lies. No. Just to actually save the
fix
family
the situation
from, and fix the situation and save the family from and entering some, let's say, quarrels.
Argument, discussion, conflict. Yeah, so just to keep the family issues.
Quarrels, yeah, right. Keep it and to lift it from the family, the pressure from the family. The husband can actually promise them with a lie in future, and later on he can say, okay, I was not able to manage it.
So right. This is one statement, just to clear it up more for the listeners. This is one statement from one of the great scholars. He states that lying has a definition, and that is to state something that is not the truth, that is not the reality. Then you ask the second question. Is every statement that is not the reality or not saying the truth, is that considered prohibited? Every single example or application of not saying the truth, is that prohibited or not? It depends. Whether there was a maslaha or a good to it, or whether there was a bad to it. Mm. And usually there's a bad to it. Usually it's not good to do it. But sometimes when you say the truth, it will cause problems. Mm. Not even more than problems. It will cause killings and deaths and murders and explosions and whatever.
Right,
whatnot.
If you want to take it that far.
Yeah. Because it
does.
It has happened.
But Brother Ali,
Brother Habib.
What, aren't you just describing a white lie?
What is your definition of white lie, so I can understand you more? I'm very sorry for that. Sorry for making you a guest right now and making myself a host. But go
on. No. For what I understand, a white lie is a lie that you say in order to not, for example, hurt the other person's feelings. Because there is a maslaha, as you said, there's a benefit.
For example,
your wife asks you, do you like the food I made you? It was horrible. You hate it. You never want to smell it or see it again. You say yes.
Yeah. Then therefore, that white lie that you call, that you define, then yes.
Right.
There's no problem with that. But you have to pay attention to all the aspects. For example, there might be something good for you in it. Because if I lie, for example, I'm going to get paid this much. I'm going to get this kind of money. At the same time, if I lie, even though it does bring good to me or bring good for others, when I lie, this person is going to lose his job. For example, I lie my CV, for example.
Yeah.
this person is going to lose his job, right? And therefore there's this, you know, tadarub or conflict between that mafsada, that bad thing, and the maslaha that you want and you crave, the good thing. So therefore, it remains from the bad aspect to not, it remains as a prohibited action.
Para, you are actually saying if you want to do this sort of permissible lying, this white lie, it must be to the benefit not just to you or to you, but also to all the Muslims. Or
society
those
together, society. You know, society together, your community.
Believers, just to summarize it, to the believers. Yeah. Okay, I am a Muslim. I live in...
Of course, we're talking... Sorry, I'm very sorry. I have to add this because it's important. Yeah? We're talking about, you know, haram. We're talking about law right now.
Right, yeah.
We're not talking about
you're
morals.
Because
al-kidhib yujurru al-kidhib. Do not joke. Do not lie while joking.
Even
do not
joking.
Joke with lie.
That's not permissible.
Because... Yeah. Small lies drag bigger lies.
Very true.
So there's this also moral aspect of not lying.
Even jokes which are in lie, or the kind of, let's say, lie that you say in the form of joke, even that is actually not permissible.
Yeah, it is prohibited. We even have the story of Prophet prohibiting that to
his
other
the topic of a Siddiqoon, right? What is a Siddiqoon? The person that tells the truth very much and that's very truthful.
Mm.
So how can you be a truthful person when you joke with lying?
Right.
There goes stand up comedy in Islam.
Well, that's a whole another topic. But just to take it back to the perspective of law before we enter the ethical debate and moral debate. I am a Muslim, I'm a believer, or to make it more clear, I'm a Shia Muslim. And either I lived 500 years back under a certain Islamic country which prosecuted Muslims, or I live in present day areas where Wahhabism or anti-Shia sentiment is present. And it is directly threatening to my life if I, for example, pray on a turba, or if I say I'm a Shia Muslim. May I lie here, Brother Ali Alouyan?
There is a greater expediency here, which is called taqiyah, or dissemination. This is a greater expediency for the sake of the survival of the lives and souls of Muslims, and this is something that even we have a Quranic witness for that as well. Allah anta tuqu minhum tuqat. So we have even in Quran that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala refers to that and ask the companions of the Prophet, you can just deny your even Islam just to tell them that you are not following Muhammad. That easy, because so this is what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala permits us to say, to save the life of
Muslims. But Brother Habib said, how can it be a Siddiq if you also lie?
That's taqiyya. See, there's a difference between
So there's this is another form of lying, but it's permissible.
Taqiyya, like how my brother stated, it's, you know, you have that fear, and if you show off, it doesn't only go back to lying, to saying that no, I'm not Muslim or I'm not Shia, right? It goes back to the fact of having fear and not doing some actions and having to lie in some situations. So it's more general. But what I want to say is that there's this topic of muwarat, where you, it's not lying. For example, I tell you, I don't have no money in my hands.
What is muwarat in English, please?
I don't know the exact translation of it. That's why I didn't translate it. But I'm going to give an example. It will become very clear. For example, I'm a poor person. I'm not going to say you're a poor person because this is the first time me doing the show. It's the third time
you shouldn't
doing
say
the show
you're a poor
with you.
Person. Say Fanan person is a poor person, for example.
No. I want to do it with me because that's how I bring up examples. Sorry, that's my way.
Okay, you're the poor person.
I come
person.
And ask you, right? And what do you say? You have money in your pockets. You have
Are
money
you asking
in your pockets.
Me for money?
Yeah.
You're a beggar.
Yeah. I have money. You have money in your pockets. But what do you do? You say, look, I have no money in my hands.
And with that, we will unfortunately have today's program because we are out of time. I thank you for your inputs, brothers. It has been very fruitful to be a part of this discussion. I hope it was also beneficial to the listeners.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep
inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in life, a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life, but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
As world leaders at COP26 earlier pledged to end deforestation by 2030, campaigners and marine conservationists say the powerful carbon sinks in the ocean are being overlooked. We have prepared for you an article written by Karen McVeigh. The piece is titled Dangerous Blind Spot: Why Overlooking Blue Carbon Could Sink Us. When the ambitious plan to allow seawater to flood over the Sturt Peninsula in Somerset, England was completed in 2014, critics called it a waste of money. Floods had recently blighted the nearby area, and some local people argued that £20 million spent on creating a new 250-hectare salt marsh would have been better spent on other flood prevention projects. 7 years ago, the concept of blue carbon, how marine ecosystems store carbon, was in its infancy. Some research had looked at how mangrove forests absorb carbon, but little was known about how efficient seagrass and salt marshes also were at absorbing greenhouse gas emissions. The two groups behind the salt marsh, the Environment Agency and the Wildfowl and Wetlands Trust, WWT, barely mentioned the climate. They said the purpose of the marsh was to protect the coast from erosion and create a new valuable habitat for bird life. Ian Little-Granger, MP for Bridgewater and West Somerset, called the marsh an extravagant, ridiculous scheme that put birds ahead of humans. However, less than 8 years later, everything has changed. Blue carbon is at the forefront of the fight against the climate crisis, and as world leaders gather at COP26 in Glasgow, evidence has emerged that the Sturt Marsh could be a more powerful carbon sink than anybody imagined. Scientists at Manchester Metropolitan University found that Sturt Marshes absorb 19 tons of organic carbon a hectare every year, or 18,000 tons in 4 years, the equivalent of eliminating the greenhouse gas emissions of 32,900 cars. Their work is part of a growing body of research suggesting blue carbon is an order of magnitude more efficient than its terrestrial equivalent. Tim McGrath, head of the project development at the Wildfowl and Wetlands Trust, WWT, which manages the salt marsh, says, "The carbon storage at Sturt is phenomenal." He adds, "These exceptional findings could indicate that the carbon storage potential of restoring salt marsh around the United Kingdom coast has been underestimated." Tim McGrath says it would take 100 years for a woodland to sequester and store as much carbon as Sturt can store in 6 years, adding, "Trees and peat can take us so far, but blue carbon ecosystems such as salt marshes can take us further. It's time governments seize this opportunity." But as world leaders at COP26 earlier pledged to end deforestation by 2030, campaigners and marine conservationists say the powerful carbon sinks in the ocean are being overlooked. Only 43 out of 113 countries to submit greenhouse gas inventories or nationally determined contributions NDCs have included blue carbon ecosystems as part of their mitigation measures. The United Kingdom, despite being a coastal nation with vast reserves of potential blue carbon, is one of those nations failing to do so. Elsa McClellan, coordinator of Our Seas, a coalition of Scottish businesses, communities and environmental groups, says, "If we are not protecting and counting the blue carbon in our seas, this leaves a dangerous blind spot for UK policy," adding, "It's time we counted blue carbon, reinstated a limit on damaging methods of fishing and put future generations first." One study suggests bottom trawling could release as much carbon as global aviation emissions. Our Seas is calling on Kwasi Kwarteng, the business secretary, to establish an accounting system for blue carbon so that marine and coastal ecosystems, including salt marshes, can be protected as part of the United Kingdom's efforts to meet its climate goals. Bill Austin, a professor in ocean science at St Andrews University in Scotland and chair of the Scottish Government's Blue Carbon Forum, says, "Blue carbon habitats are some of the most effective carbon sequestration habitats, area for area, on the planet." He's working on a government-funded salt marsh code that could allow companies to invest in restoration schemes. Bill Austin says for now, blue carbon remains a bit of an outlier when it comes to carbon credits. Out of the big three coastal wetlands, mangroves are the best studied, followed by salt marshes and then seagrass. He says, "There is definitely scope for us to raise our ambition by including blue carbon in the United Kingdom's nationally determined contributions." The Department of the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs claims the United Kingdom recognises the important role blue carbon habitats can play in carbon sequestration, as well as preventing biodiversity loss and building resilience to climate crises. The ocean plays a vital role in climate mitigation, and we continue to build the evidence base on blue carbon habitats as we strive towards net zero emissions. That is a coded way of saying that the science of blue carbon is relatively young. The term was coined back in 2009. Recent research estimates that conserving and restoring blue carbon ecosystems could remove the equivalent of 3% of annual global greenhouse gas emissions. But the future is another country, and one leading expert predicts that, over time, the ocean's contribution towards mitigating climate emissions could soar. Carlos Duarte, a professor of marine science, says 3% was a conservative estimate because the scope for restoration of some ecosystems could be larger than previously believed. Carlos Duarte says, "It is very well understood for mangroves, not well understood for salt marshes, and very poorly understood for seagrass." He adds, "We have huge gaps in our knowledge of the amount of seagrass in the ocean. The scope for restoring seagrass could be as much as 5 or 10 times larger than what we have thought." He predicts the contribution of blue carbon to mitigating climate emissions could be as high as 10% to 15% if all blue carbon strategies are activated, including as yet unexplored possibilities such as more seaweed farming, avoiding disturbing sediments on continental shelves, and restoring kelp forests and protecting whales. Other scientists have cautioned that uncertainty in some areas such as seaweed farms and kelp, neither of which are included in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's Greenhouse Gas Emissions Inventory, makes accurate predictions difficult. That's why Carlos Duarte wants to study those areas. He is working with Oceans 2050, an organization run by Alexandra Cousteau, the granddaughter of the famous oceanographer Jacques Cousteau, to sample sediments from seaweed farms in 12 countries to find out how much carbon they really soak up. Carlos Duarte says, "I would be hard-pressed to find a climate mitigation solution that has been proven to be as effective as blue carbon," adding, "Some people worry that 3% is too little to worry about. So these people, in search of solutions that are going to magically deliver many better grams of emission, I tell them, there are no low-hanging better grams." Duarte says there is no time to waste arguing over exactly how much blue carbon can help us cut emissions. All options must be pursued. Blue carbon ecosystems do not just reduce emissions, they help fight the other crises, such as biodiversity loss and preventing natural disasters. Carlos Duarte says blue carbon has been overlooked for far too long, adding, "By the time we find these solutions that can deliver 5% of the job, we will be in 2050, and we will be burning."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.